All the street lights around me, in the wall-to-wall prison of my city.
Good evening, everyone. Good evening. I'm Carolyn Baker, and I welcome you to the Lifeboat Hour tonight. 2 weeks following the loss of our brother, friend, mentor, and truth-teller, Mike Rupert. Tonight, we're going to talk about grief and loss and why the community and the earth need our grief. On February 23rd, when Mike was moving back to Northern California, Francis Weller was my guest on this show, and we talked in depth then about grief in the context of our planetary predicament. But tonight, we're going to talk about grief in the context not only of our planetary predicament, but in the context of the passing of Mike Rupert. Francis is back with us tonight, and I want to say that I consider him the foremost expert on grief in this country. And on the day after Mike took his life, my mind immediately went back to the show that I did with Francis on February 23rd, and I knew that it was time to have Francis return as one of the voices we most need at this time. Personally, I've been away for the last week or so taking some downtime following Mike's passing, and I'll be back at work on Tuesday, but in doing this work, it is extremely important to take care of oneself. So really, this is the first quote-unquote work I've actually done since last Monday. Before we get into the show, I have two very important announcements to make. One is that the day and time of this show are going to change. The new Lifeboat Hour is going to air on Monday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Now, I have no control over this change, but I'm happy about it, and I'm very glad that Progressive Radio Network archives every show so that listeners can catch the show the day following its airing. So once again, the new time is Monday at 8 p.m., that's Eastern Time, beginning May 5th. Not tomorrow night, but Monday, May 5th. To find an archive of any show, go to prn.fm, click on Shows, and scroll down to the Lifeboat Hour. The other announcement is that many of you know that there will be an online celebration of life for Mike on May 8th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And you must register for this in advance. So the way that you do that is to go to SyncCast. That's SyncCast.net. Or you could go to my website at CarolynBaker.net. Or you may encounter the post on Facebook. And if you do, you can, you'll be directed on how to register there by going to SyncCast. So this is a fabulous opportunity provided by the folks at SyncCast to pay tribute to Mike, to share our thoughts and feelings. This tribute that we began here, actually, last Sunday night on this show. Again, that's Thursday, May the 8th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Register at SyncCast, SyncCast.net, or at my website, CarolynBaker.net. So in a moment, we're going to hear from Francis, but I'd like to preface the introduction by noting that last week, during the special tribute show that I did for Mike, we had some people calling in whose hearts were broken. And a couple of those people apologized for weeping. And I very quickly told them that they had nothing to apologize for, but all week I've been thinking about what this culture does to us around grief, and that in itself breaks my heart. No, in this culture, we're told that grief is something to be ashamed of, that we should keep it to ourselves and be so-called dignified about it. Do the Jackie Kennedy performance where we wear shades and show up looking regal. Or better yet, we should do it entirely behind closed doors. We're told that if we allow our grief to be present, we'll somehow, quote-unquote, get stuck in it. We'll get sucked into a grief vortex from which we'll never return. If we start crying, we'll never stop. And besides that, they tell us grief is messy, embarrassing, weak, irrational, and useless. What's the point of crying over spilled milk? But our guest tonight, Frances Weller, has written a fabulous little book on grief called Entering the Healing Ground, Grief, Ritual, and the Soul of the World. It's a so-called little book, but of massive magnitude. Frances Weller, marriage and family therapist, is a psychotherapist, writer, and soul activist. He's a master of synthesizing diverse streams of thought from psychology, anthropology, mythology, alchemy, indigenous cultures, and poetic traditions. Frances received a BA from the University of Wisconsin at Green Bay and two master's degrees from John F. Kennedy University in clinical psychology and transpersonal psychology. His writings have appeared in anthologies and journals exploring the confluence between psyche, nature, and culture. He's a frequent presenter and keynote speaker at conferences, bringing insight, poetry, and a breath of humor to his talks. Frances is currently on staff at Commonweal Cancer Help Program in Northern California, co-leading their week-long retreats with Michael Lerner, and he's taught at Sonoma State University, the New College of California, and the Sophia Center in Oakland. He's currently completing his second book, A Trail on the Ground, Tracking the Ways of the Indigenous Soul. It is an honor to welcome you again to the show, Frances.
Thank you, Carolyn. I wish we were meeting under other circumstances, but it's good to hear your voice again.
Thank you. You know, when someone we love dies, and especially when they take their own life, we quite naturally try to make sense of it by analyzing why they died at the particular time they died, and we often go through a lot of what-ifs, perhaps because we think it won't be so painful if we can find a reason why. But then where does grief come in, and what happens if eventually we don't grieve this kind of loss?
Well, I think the what-ifs are one way that we try to get a little shelter from the intensity of the grief.
Yes.
It keeps it a little bit at arm's length. And I remember this line of Rumi's, he said, if the mind, the eye goes blind when it only wants to see why.
Mm.
And there's certain pieces of this experience around Mike or any death that comes in that close to us that we cannot process with our minds, with the cognition. It happens in the heart. It happens in the soul. And that place is often very far beyond the rational territory. And I think one of the things that happens, particularly with suicide, is that we no longer are just experiencing grief. We're experiencing grief merging with trauma.
Yes.
And we enter in an entirely different process at that point. When trauma is activated through that type of experience, the whole structure of defense around dissociation, numbing, agitation, withdrawal, all those things get kicked into motion. And it makes it very difficult for us to digest the actual grief that's present.
In other words, it really stirs the pot, doesn't it?
Yes, it almost knocks the pot over.
Yes.
You know, what I've seen in my practice many times and in grief rituals is that when grief arises that has any association with trauma, whether an event trauma or what I call slow trauma, which has to do more with a neglect or an absence that chronically weighs us down. And when that trauma gets triggered, the response is oftentimes one of slipping into a very primitive state.
Mm.
It's as if who's doing the grieving is a child rather than an adult.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so one of our most important pieces of work is to help migrate the grief from the child's hands into an adult's hands.
Mm.
And that's not always easy to do.
No, and I think how people respond to that is they try to get up in their heads and then start the analysis because maybe they don't know how to do that or have tools for doing that, and that's why I love your work so much is because you give us those tools.
Right. You know, the typical association with grief is to try to figure it out.
Yeah.
To try to, you know, work and muscle our way through it through analysis, like you said. And what it typically does then is it pushes grief further to the background, and then it begins to kind of haunt our days.
Yes.
And overshadow our lives. And most of the people who come into my practice come in because they're saying they're self-diagnosed or oftentimes clinically diagnosed by their physicians as depressed. But really what's going on is this unmetabolized grief that's been accumulated for oftentimes for decades.
Well, I just want to let everyone know that we're going to have a time for callers to call in a little bit later, but I want to ask you another question that's even more personal in relation to Mike. About 6 weeks or a month ago, perhaps, you had lunch with Mike, and I wonder what that was like for you. I know that he was very impressed with your being on the show on February 23rd when he was in the process of moving back to California from Colorado, and I was hosting for him. Can you say more about your time with him?
Well, it was good. It was like two old veterans of frontline cultural exchange getting together for the first time.
And
we had a very rich conversation about our work, our mutual approaches, and what was real clear was the amount of pain he was carrying. He looked like someone very weathered by his encounters with life.
Mm-hmm.
I know his life was not easy. And he shared a lot of his personal stories with me, and I shared mine with him.
Mm-hmm.
Part of what got stirred was a sense of kinship that we were talking about how we would collaborate with each other in the future. And I was looking forward to various ways of, you know, connecting, and his death was quite a shock. I mean, just a profound shock.
Yes. I guess you found out about it on Facebook. Was that how you found
it? Yeah, I think from your posting.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Last Sunday we did a tribute show for Mike, and as I said, a number of people called in expressing their grief, and some people just very naturally began weeping, and then some of them began to apologize for crying, and I kept telling them that it was not only okay, but very appropriate to cry about this enormous, tragic loss, and I'm sure you have more to say about that.
Well, I can't think of a more natural response to loss than tears. You know, I mean, just watch a child when they're in pain or dealing with something, you know, losing something, they're grief and their tears are immediate and whole-bodied.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't ever stop and say, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
There's no apology built into our grief structure. It is something that slowly accumulates over time, where we're taught very powerfully that what we're showing, what we're displaying is somehow inappropriate or wrong. So, and then we end up having grief and shame binding together.
Yes.
So it's rare to have, again, to have just a pure grief moment,
mm-hmm.
particularly in public. We live in what I call a very heroic culture.
Yeah, would you say more about that? Because I think people misunderstand that word, heroic, sometimes.
Well, the hero is a beautiful image. It's a gorgeous image, a gorgeous archetype for our youth.
Mm-hmm.
There's a point at which we need to allow that image to fade and move into other modes, mentoring, eldering, all different modes of being adults. But the heroic image, if it's the only image we have, teaches us that we must always be in control, always be successful, always rising above, and also in a very powerful way, always be isolate.
Yes.
The hero needs no one.
Mm.
See, the ancient hero was always bound to the village. He did this on behalf, or she did this on behalf of, not for their own sake. It was an act of sacrifice. The hero was always bound in some sacrificial way to a larger purpose, a larger cause. Now the hero, as we've seen in our cultural definitions, oftentimes ends up serving himself, or is very isolated in his story.
Right.
So when that's put on top of our emotional life, the range of what we get to express is incredibly condensed. And we feel shame for any emotion that, you know, quote-unquote, brings us down. We're always supposed to be up, the smiley face. Everything's fine. Everything's good. But when things like this hit us, like Mike's death, and when I read your email and I walked out into the living room, my wife looked at me and she said, "You look stricken."
Mm.
And that's the soul's response to something so rupturing to our being that we are supposed to show this on our face, in our words, in our tears, in our full expression. This is what's meant to be done in order to stay sane and present.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, you know, one of the things I hope can happen when we have our online celebration of life is, you know, tributes. I don't have an agenda for it by any means, but I'm going to be hosting it. And I hope that we can get, in addition to the tributes, people being able to express their feelings, whatever those are. And if tears come, you know, I want people to know that they have full permission for the tears to come. Not that this is going to be a cyber wailing wall, but if we have sadness and sorrow there in a very authentic way, that's absolutely fine and appropriate. And it is a very adult and authentic expression of what we feel.
Right. Absolutely true. And I'm glad you're doing that, Carolyn.
Thank you. And, you know, another comment I'd like to make here, which, you know, we mentioned a moment ago, but I want to take it a little further, is that for days after Mike's death, we had people insisting vehemently that he didn't commit suicide. And those of us who were very close to him absolutely knew that he had committed suicide, and for a number of reasons. But some people insisted that he was taken out because he was a whistleblower and that suicide was a cover story. And my response to those many comments is that vehement insistence on murder in the face of massive evidence of suicide is the first stage of denial, and denial is the first of the five stages of grief. So those of us close to Mike heard him speak about suicide for at least a decade, and speaking for myself, I have to say, you know, when people ask me how I was feeling about it, what my response was, I said I was blown away but not surprised when I heard the news. So do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, I agree with what you're saying, and I think it's understandable and in some ways instructive when we look to find some other reason why this happened. You know, I think particularly people who are in progressive movements or spiritual movements, we are always supposed to strive for life.
Yes.
And the betterment of the world and for self-healing and cultural healing. So this idea of someone deliberately and choicefully ending their life, that's the shock.
Yes.
It's not so much, you know, that he died, but that he's not supposed to have done that.
Right.
We're supposed to always want to move in this other direction. And particularly to people who are, again, more in that spiritual, political realm, this is such an affront to some value structure we try to hold on to.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if we're really honest, if we really can say, I have certainly had to wrestle with thoughts of suicide.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was even in one of the questions you asked me last month, or in February when we talked, about why not just commit suicide if
right.
things are so dire. So, the thing is, when we literalize that impulse to death, we may have missed another calling for something, that something does need to die.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's a way of living.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe even culturally there's a collective death that we need to go through.
Yes.
But I think it really shocks us in our sensibilities that want to make sure everything's always going towards life.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's hard to digest that.
It certainly is.
I think suicide itself is so deeply rooted in grief.
Mm-hmm.
You know, particularly unexpressed grief.
Yes, absolutely. This is Carolyn Baker on the Lifeboat Hour, and we're going to take a little brief station break, and we will be back dialoguing with Francis Weller. Once again, this is Carolyn Baker on the Lifeboat Hour at Progressive Radio Network. I'm talking with Francis Weller, who is the author of Entering the Healing Ground, Grief, Ritual, and the Soul of the World. And we're talking about grief tonight in the context of a withering planet, but also in the context of Mike Rupert's passing. And Francis, I'm aware that at least once a year you hold a grief ritual in your community in Northern California. Last time you were on the show, you were about ready to do one of these, and so you did a grief workshop ritual last month, and I'm wondering if you can tell us in a general way how it was and what you learned this time. And also, I was noticing on your website that you have a similar event coming up in May, so would you say more about all of that?
Well, the ritual was a very powerful gathering of 27 people from all over the country.
Say that number again, 27.
We usually ended at 25 just to keep it at a scale that we can, you know, in a sense, know one another in the process of a weekend.
Right.
We added a few extras, and it was quite interesting to see that so many of the people were coming from far, far away, which was wonderful. People coming from Massachusetts and Florida and England, a group of four people from Mexico. It's wonderful, but at the same time kind of shocking that we have to travel so far to do grief work.
Oh, yes.
So it's, you know, it's both, again, illustrative that we are not tending the grief of our communities. So that's part of what I'm coming away from the weekend with, is that it's shockingly thin out there in terms of how we are addressing our collective and personal sorrows. So we have to, again, come long distances. But what I noticed, again, is this beautiful thing that happens, this incredibly generative thing that happens when even strangers gather together over the course of 3 days to share their sorrows in their hearts. So there were veterans there from multiple wars. There were people who dealt with suicides of parents and children, people who have dealt with violence and addictions and all kinds of means by which the grief arrived in their lives. But the commonality, what I call the commons of the soul, was the fact that we all know sorrow. And we're all waiting for the permission, for some granting of permission to be able to be together and speak the sorrows in our hearts. And that's what we're longing for.
I certainly notice that as people are approaching me to come and do grief rituals and workshops and so forth. It just seems like there's such a huge demand for it. And you're right, it's tragic that we have to travel so far to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I oftentimes joke at the beginning of the gathering, it's a kind of a tongue-in-cheek joke, but it seems so strange that we have to have a workshop on grief.
Right.
And that's how far we've come from this primary experience of being human. And I look at all the workshops that are out there on sexuality, on relationships, on play, on creativity. These are basics. These are givens as human beings, but look how far we've come from them, that we have to actually be retrained.
Yes.
On how to live
absolutely.
Again.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you're going to have another event coming up in May. Is that going to be similar or different?
It'll be different. It's a little longer process. And let's see, the next one that's a three-day weekend is in August. But again, that one's basically also full. So
weren't you doing these just maybe once a year, and now it sounds like you're doing them a little oftener?
Well, the invitations are coming in from wider areas.
I see.
We're going to be up in Canada in July. And so, yeah, it's I mean, again, I think it's a sign of something shifting collectively that there's more openness to this. I think I shared it when we talked in February, Carolyn.
Yes.
Early on, we had to almost coax people to come to the events, and now they're basically full before we start, and before we get much of an advertisement out there.
Amazing, but not surprising.
Yeah.
Now, I want to tell our listeners, we're going to be taking calls in a while, and the number to call is 888-874-4888 to ask a question or make a comment to Frances. The next thing that I want to ask you, Frances, is you talked last time a little bit about the relationship between grief and joy and grief and gratitude. Can you say more about that again, please?
Sure. I mean, I think we have to remember that psyche, or soul, is a very integrated system. It's an integrated organism. And you can't deny one piece selectively without affecting all the others.
Mm.
So when we shut down grief, when we refuse to walk into that room in the house of our soul, it has an interesting way of locking most of the other doors. So we don't get to have simply access to joy if we don't also access grief.
I love that.
So deeply integrated.
Yes.
That, in fact, in the middle of our grief rituals, frequently, there is this movement of joy beginning to stir about two-thirds, three-quarters of the way through the ritual.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes during our gratitude gatherings, there will be a moment of melancholy.
Yes.
So I call them sisters, and they are dear sisters of one another. And we can't really hope to have any measure of joy in our life if we do not also welcome sorrow. And this harkens back to an old phrase of William Blake's, where he said, the deeper the sorrow, the greater the joy.
Yes.
So they are totally interdependent with one another.
Well, you know, I think of your work and Melodoma Somme's work around grief, and the fact that our tears are obviously water, and so there's this solution of grief in the psyche that, you know, touches everything else. Water, you know, just flows. And so one thing touches another. It can't be walled off.
No, that's a state of deadness, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, and that's, again, the symptom of depression is more a symptom of removal. It's a symptom of disconnection from the rhythm and movement of life. And in a sense, you know, human beings are more verb than noun.
Mm.
We're more a rhythm, a pulse, a movement, a sensation, a dance, a poem than we are a static thing.
Yes.
But when we resist the movement of emotion, I mean, the literal word is literally emotion, it's energy in motion.
Yes.
When we stifle that, when we hinder that, we become a rigid, ossified, nearly fossilized thing. And that's again, why the power of grief is so amazing to me, is it is what I consider one of the primary solvents in the psyche. It can soften and loosen the most hardened places in our beings. And you can see that sometime when somebody has been overly rigid in their lives and they suffer the loss of a pet.
Mm-hmm.
Something happens.
Yes.
Slips underneath the armor and the closed and locked door, and something happens in their heart and they break down.
Absolutely.
And that is a moment of redemption, a moment of deep and profound grace that comes into the heart through sorrow.
Yes.
You know?
Well, you know, you've sort of answered this question, but I'm going to go ahead and ask it anyway, because you may want to have a different response. Why is grief so important for activists and people who are working hard to tell the truth about our predicament and to bring about a change in consciousness?
Well, it's really, really challenging to keep our face turned into the wind of such difficult and dark material. So when we're looking at the nature of culture and the nature of the planet, the ecosystems and so forth, and there's no means by which we get to empty that cup regularly, we will soon drown. Or what we'll do again is harden. and we will become militant in our approach, but not coming from a place of love.
Right.
We have to remember that any true activism that has to do with protecting or saving or doing anything on behalf of the planet hopefully is an act of deep and profound affection. And in order for that affection to be my prime cause in my choice to act, I have to keep the heart soft, I have to keep the heart fluid, and that means having regular times at the grief shrine.
Yes.
I have to keep emptying that cup.
Mm.
We've had many activists come through our grief rituals, and that's their primary symptom, is they feel burned out. And they used the image of water before. Mm. Well, if there's too much fire, if you're just kind of dealing with too much of the heat of what's going on, at times you need the water to help soothe, cool, cleanse, and refresh, so you can continue this beautiful dance between the out-breath and the in-breath. You know, Rumi had that wonderful image of the bird wings, you know, that we know, if the hand is always opened or always closed, you would be paralyzed. Your greatest essence is in every subtle opening and closing, as beautifully coordinated as bird wings.
Oh, I love that. That's
so if we're always out there in an activist place,
mm-hmm.
we will burn out and, in a sense, become petrified.
Yes.
He said.
Yes.
Or if we're always withdrawn and always insulated, we will suffer the same outcome. So we need this beautiful coordination between activism and renewal.
A beautiful dance, yes?
A beautiful dance.
Yeah. Okay, I really want to open the line now for callers. If you have a question or a comment for Francis at 888-874-4888, this is Carolyn Baker on the Lifeboat Hour, and we welcome your comments and questions. So, you know, we talk a lot about, and Mike talked a lot about on the show, how much we need community. And, you know, there's so many problems with people from the West or non-Indigenous groups who don't really have experience in developing community. How does public grieving in a group of individuals who've come together for that purpose help develop community?
What I think happens fairly rapidly is that the fiction of separation falls away.
Mm.
You know, and when you're listening to the deep story that each person carries about their particular encounter with loss and grief, you begin to feel a deep connection with that human being, that there really is no real ostensible difference between the two of us. You know, Victor Turner used the term communitas,
mm-hmm.
which describes the outcome, not always guaranteed, but a possible outcome from entering into deep ritual space together. And communitas is one of those words that is hard to define, but it speaks to a place of leavening where all of our differences are, in a sense, dissipated into the shared communal draw of who we all are as human beings. And when we can enter into that space, now we recognize the deeper feeling of community.
Yes.
Ah, this is what I have been longing for. Remember one woman at one of our gatherings spoke in the first circle saying, I am so terrified to be here, but I have so much loss I cannot not be here.
Mm.
And by the end of the weekend, she was calling people, you know, my brothers, my sisters. So you move through all of the fictions that we have accumulated about difference, about not belonging, and we are brought back into a deeper memory that we are all designed to participate in this type of experience. I mean, R.D. Lang said we all arrive here as Stone Age children.
Yes, I love that.
We're all wired in a very particular way to expect what we actually encounter on these weekends. The rest of the time is what's not normal.
Exactly, exactly. You know, we have a caller. We have Ann from Oklahoma. Go ahead, Ann. Do you have a question or comment for Francis?
Yes, my name is Amy.
Amy, okay, sorry.
And my question is, how do you deal with regrets in the grieving process?
Amy, that's...
Because I am overwhelmed with regrets, and I'm going through the grief stages. I know I go back and forth between all of them, but the biggest thing I have is regret.
Mm.
Well, what... Over the things I never said, the things I never did.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you for that question, Amy. I know when I was writing the book, I put a section in there that regret could actually warrant its own gate of grief. It is such a deep piece for us to carry, and what we have to do is hold regrets, all of the regrets, with the most soft-handed compassion that we can find, and begin to recall who I was in that moment in which I was not able to speak, or when I chose to move in a certain way and withhold love, or withhold touch, or withhold whatever it was, or whatever choices I made. The only thing I can do now is turn towards that part of me that was then and hold it with supreme compassion. And hopefully that compassion will be able to soften the judgments. See, part of what regret evokes is tremendous feelings of self-judgment, like I did it wrong. And it's very hard to move into a space of grieving and letting go when there's also the associated feeling of, I did wrong, I didn't do it right.
You know, if I might just add, Amy, that a very wise person said to me a couple of years ago, it's hard to forgive ourselves for things we did in order to survive. And sometimes we have to look back with that perspective that, you know, I wouldn't have done that thing today, but I had to do that to survive.
Well, the main thing I have a regret about is never telling someone how I felt and what my feelings were, and now that person is dead.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the things that I wanted to say that, hey, you're a human being hurting, and I can see that because I'm hurting too.
Right.
I was afraid to open up about
because
I had all my fears, and I didn't let go of them in enough time.
And can you have compassion for that part of you that was afraid? I mean, that's part of the deep work, Amy, is can I have compassion for the part of me that was not able to speak?
Right.
You know, in the grief rituals, frequently people will write letters to the people that they did not speak to, that they did not finish, that they did not express what they needed to say to them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and bring that to the shrine and speak it across the shrine, and hopefully that it will land in the ears of the ancestors.
I sometimes suggest to people, you know, even if they can't participate in a grief ritual, if they can write that letter for themselves. You know, obviously if the person they're writing to is dead, they can't send it, but they can certainly go through that process of writing that letter and getting those feelings out. And you know, we do it for ourselves as much as we would do it for the other person. I thank you for your call, Amy. We've got another call it's from Kim from Sydney. And would you go ahead, please?
Hi there, Carolyn and Francis. Francis, I was with you at Ghost Ranch decades ago in New Mexico, and thank you so much for speaking today. Here's my question. How could we start conversations with people in our day-to-day lives about getting together with the goal towards perhaps home-growing some grief rituals? Because I can't afford to fly you down, nor do I believe in the petrol.
Well,
good question, Kim.
Thank you for your call, and good to hear from you. I think the basic thing we can do is, and I say this to many people who ask that very same question, is find two or three people and invite them over to your home and say, on Friday night or Saturday night, we're going to get together and we're going to break a taboo. We're going to talk about loss. And we're going to talk about our feelings associated with loss, but under the agreement that we all resist trying to fix it or trying to offer advice. There's nothing broken. See, grief is not something that's in need of repair. It is a presence that is needing witnessing. So part of what you can offer in that very simple way is a chance for people to speak. Like I said before, what part of what we're waiting for is permission. And I remember down in Point Reyes, a little town south of here, my wife and I did a grief ritual earlier this year, and out of that grew a monthly grief circle that they are holding in their little town, and people are showing up and sharing their stories. So it doesn't have to be an elaborate thing; it can be a very simple thing. But make sure that we can all come together without feeling that we have to take care of each other, but we can care for each other in that space.
Beautiful. That has just spurred a lot of ideas in my own little circle here. So
good.
Thanks much and blessings, guys, and we'll see you on the 8th.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kim. And again, the number to call is 888-874-4888 if you have a question for Frances or a comment. Well, we're waiting for another caller, hopefully. I just want to ask you, it seems in terms of grieving that women have an easier time than men. And from my perspective, men have so much to grieve in this culture. I believe that both women and men are horribly oppressed and wounded in our culture. And back in the day and even today, some feminists said and still say that men don't have so much to grieve about because they're the privileged ones. But what do men have to grieve about, and how is the grief of men and women different?
Well, Carolyn, I think we should spend about 3 weeks talking about this.
Yeah, I know. I don't ask you light questions when you come on this show because you're not a lightweight.
Men have so much to grieve over. I mean, I do a lot of men's initiation work, and the very first weekend we work with two themes. One of them is rekindling a reverence for life, including our own. And then the grief attached to the fact that we haven't most of our entire life. We've lived, with an irreverent attitude towards our own being for most of our life. So what do men have to grieve? Well, most every piece of conditioning a man goes through isolates him. It teaches him how to be competitive, how to achieve, and how to be isolated. But it does not teach him how to be in relationship. I mean, every time I'm in therapy with a couple, a heterosexual couple, I hear the woman say, he doesn't relate to me. And I have to slowly educate her over the fact that he's not been taught how to do that. You know, and he feels ashamed and guilty for the fact that he can't do it. But what men are conditioned to do is to notice where they are in the hierarchy of things, but not how to enter into relationship with things. So there's a profound loneliness in men and a profound feeling of inadequacy that courses through most of the men that I know. And so that leads to this feeling of being ashamed, and which adds to the feeling of needing to be hidden and withdrawn and not tell anybody how I feel. Women, I'm grossly generalizing here.
Right.
But women that I see in my practice, the primary grief they carry is this feeling of not mattering.
Mm-hmm.
That somehow I don't matter. And it's hard not to feel that way in a culture that doesn't honor their value or their sovereignty or their worth in any primary way. So they carry a slightly different feeling of grief, but again, a mutually entangled grief with men. All of that grief is, mutually entangled by the more a man feels isolated and withdrawn and inadequate, the harder it is for him to engage a woman in a meaningful way. So they both end up feeding each other in a very lose-lose kind of situation.
Right. We have another caller, but before I take that call, I want you to tell us how we can get in touch with you. How can people get in touch with you by email or whatever you prefer?
Okay. My email is fweller@earthlink.net. That's fweller@earthlink.net. Or you can visit either one of my websites, wisdombridge.net or enteringthehealingground.com.
Would you say those two websites again, please?
Sure. Wisdom Bridge, one word, wisdombridge.net, or enteringthehealingground.com.
Very good. Thank you. We have Colleen from California. Go ahead, Colleen.
Hi, yes, this is Lois. I was a friend of Mike's for the last few years, but I specifically wanted to speak to the woman who called in earlier that spoke of regret.
Yes.
And she was feeling so sad, obviously, and I just wanted to share a story quickly from when I was in my early 20s, and I was dating a man that I thought I was in love with, and I left him in a very unnice way and moved on with my crazy life. But years later, he died by a drowning. And my best friend finally came out at me with this real anger at what I had done to him. And I remember it was an epiphany because at that moment I thought, oh, my God, I didn't think that I had, you know, enough worth to have impacted anybody like that.
Yeah.
And I think that is, you know, what a lot of us feel. We hurt people without any cognizance of our own self-worth when we're doing it. And I do believe that the people that leave us understand that and forgive us. And I just wanted to... I hope that lady's still listening because they hear us. They're still there. They're not dead. And I've grieved Michael like we all have. And my soulmate shot himself a little over a year ago. And that's been one of the most profound experiences of my life. And I now know that neither of them are dead. Mm. They're just somewhere else, and they know. They hear us, they love us, they forgive us, and we have to forgive them, too.
Well, thank you so much for that, Colleen. I really appreciate your call. And, you know, as Colleen was talking, I was also thinking about grief in relation to the planet and our facing possible near-term extinction.
Exactly.
And so, Francis, I wonder if you could talk about that a bit and also bring in that notion of good manners, which you talked about last time. It's so important.
Well, I remember your question quite vividly and how difficult it was to think my way through it. The question about what would, you know, why bother grieving when so many of the systems of our planet look like they are in great decline, potentially leaving us with a near-term extinction of our species, why bother grieving? And I couldn't think of an answer, literally could not think of one, so I had to go to sleep with that question. And somewhere in the nighttime, some other moment of inspiration came, and when I woke in the morning, I told my wife, I think I have an answer. And I think it comes down to this question of good manners, that whatever circumstances are lying ahead of us, which we are not entirely sure, hopefully there'll be some grace, but we have a spiritual and moral obligation, in the deepest sense of that word, to do whatever we can to mitigate against loss and damage to those beings and those species that will survive beyond us. And so whatever we can do to make sure the salmon have free access to the entire range of their wild rivers, and whatever we can do to maintain the integrity of the prairies or the viability of a watershed, that's in our spiritual responsibility to do. And that's really the good manners that almost every indigenous culture I know of speaks about, that it is something that warrants an imagination that takes us into something beyond my own personal need and my own personal satisfaction. It's what I call uncentering the human. And I have to uncenter myself from myself to once again step into the broader and deeper affinity that I share with all beings everywhere. And when I touch into that, then I'm in the place of good manners. I will act accordingly.
You know, I think another thing that grief does for us is it just gives us more compassion. And one of the things that I talk about a lot in terms of, you know, in the context of near-term extinction and this possible living in a hospice situation that humanity has put itself in at the present time, I think about kindness. And I just want to bring in Naomi Shihab Nye's poem on kindness. I think it's worth stating this poem tonight.
It's an excellent poem.
She says, "Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things, feel the future dissolve in a moment like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride thinking the bus will never stop, the passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore, only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, 'It is I you have been looking for,' and then goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend." That's Kindness by Naomi Shihab Nye.
Yes.
So in the few moments that we have left, Frances, people can get in touch with you at wisdombridge.net and at enteringthehealingground.net. Is that correct?
.com.
.com.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you're going to be having some future grief rituals or workshops?
Yeah, the next one, there's one up in Victoria, Canada in July, and one in Marin County here in California in August, and that's the next two scheduled ones for us.
And you're doing some grieving in California as a collective state with a tremendous drought there that now is covering every inch of the state, it sounds like.
Every inch.
Yes.
You know, the last two grief rituals we did here, the very next day it rained, so we're thinking we should be doing grief rituals, you know.
All over the state.
maybe every week over the over the state, yes. That's right.
I want to thank you, Frances, so much for being with us. I want to thank all of you who came in as listeners tonight, all of you who called. This is Carolyn Baker on the Lifeboat Hour. Please join me on Monday night, May the 5th, here at PRN at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And please join us on Thursday, May the 8th, on the Syncast Net for an online celebration of the life of Mike Rupert. I look forward to being with you all again on May the 5th. Thank you for listening.
Flickering dirty neon over alleys mean and dirty streets, while my neighborhood is torn down around me. Too many people on the zombie streets, and the sirens make an eerie sound around me. Makes me cold, makes me hot, makes me freeze. And it's getting hard in the inner reefs. Ever strange beneath the streets. All around where all the light waves meet.
Where all the light waves meet and dance in secret.
Kids with toys haunt the hallways, stuffing secrets up my sleeve.
And the only country club around here is the cold cement under my feet. Most days I feel like a drowning man in a sea of drunken fees. While this world goes on in a whirl around me, people look before they speak. And it's getting hard in the inner reach of a strength.